Thank you for tuning into Black Books Live. This is your host, Jason Harris, and today we are traveling straight to the Harlem Renaissance with the short stories of the amazing Langston Hughes. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment. Thank you for joining us again for Black Books Live, where we share the light and beauty of great Black literature for the whole world to hear. Today we are returning after a long hiatus, but we are coming back with a bang, as today we are featuring one of the icons of the Harlem Renaissance and one of the fathers of Black literature, Langston Hughes. James Mercer Langston Hughes was born February 1st, 1901 in Joplin, Missouri. His parents divorced when he was a young child, and he was raised by his grandmother until he was 13. He moved to Lincoln, Illinois with his mother and her husband for a spell, before the family eventually settled in Cleveland, Ohio. Hughes began writing poetry as a teen, and after graduating from high school, he spent a year in Mexico with his father, followed by a year at Columbia University in New York City. During this time, he worked odd jobs and began to write in earnest. Hughes claimed Paul Laurence Dunbar, Carl Sandburg, and Walt Whitman as his primary influences. In November 1924, he moved to Washington, D.C., and in 1926, Hughes' first book of poetry, The Weary Blues, was published by Alfred A. Knopf. He graduated from Lincoln University in 1929, and in 1930, his first novel, Not Without Laughter, won the Harmon Gold Medal for Literature. Harlem functioned as Hughes' muse, and he wrote novels, short stories, plays, and poetry, in particular being connected to the world of jazz. His work was one of the cornerstones that defined the Harlem Renaissance. But Hughes' vision encompassed the stories of Black people throughout the United States. He established his voice through a variety of mediums, contributing articles and writing a long-standing newspaper column in the Chicago Defender and other papers to develop the Jesse B. Semple character, which turned into four volumes of prose. He compiled and edited The Poetry of the Negro alongside Arna Barnes, bringing new Black voices into the literary fold, and he penned a dozen plays, children's books, and the acclaimed autobiography, The Big C. The critic Donald B. Gibson noted in The Introduction to Modern Black Poets, a collection of critical essays published by Prentice Hall in 1973, that Hughes differed from most of his predecessors amongst Black poets, in that he addressed his poetry to the people, specifically Black people. During the 20s, when most American poets were turning inward, writing obscure and esoteric poetry to an ever-decreasing audience of readers, Hughes was turning outward, using language and themes, attitudes and ideas familiar to anyone who had the ability simply to read. Langston Hughes joined the ancestors on May 22, 1967 in New York City. In his memory, his residence at 20 East 127th Street in Harlem has been given landmark status. His ashes are interred beneath a floor medallion in the middle of the foyer at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in Harlem. Today, Black Books Live will present three of Hughes' works of short fiction: Rock Church, Trouble with Angels, and Spanish Blood, a short story by Langston Hughes that was first published in Metropolis magazine in 1934. Now, without further ado, Black Books Live proudly presents Langston Hughes.
Elder William Jones was one of them rock church preachers who knew how to make the spirit rise and the soul get right. Sometimes in the pulpit, he used to start talking real slow. And you'd think his sermon weren't going to be nothing. But by the time he got through, the walls of the temple would be almost rent. The doors busted open and the benches turned over from pure shouting on the part of the brothers and sisters. He were a great preacher, was Reverend William Jones. But he weren't satisfied. He wanted to be greater than he was. He wanted to be another Billy Graham or Elmer Gantry or a resurrected Daddy Grace. And that's what brought about his downfall. Ambition. Now, Reverend Jones had been for nearly a year the pastor of one of them little colored churches in the back alleys of St. Louis that are open every night in the week for preaching, singing, and praying, where sisters come to shake tambourines, shout, sing gospel songs, and get happy while the Reverend presents the word. Elder Jones always opened his part of the services with In His Hand, his theme song, and he always closed his services with the same. Now, the rhythm of In His Hand was such that once it got to swinging, you couldn't help but move your arms or feet or both. And since the Reverend always took up collection at the beginning and ending of his sermons, the dancing movement of the crowd at such times was always towards the collection table, which was exactly where the elder wanted it to be. In His Hand, In His Hand, I'm safe and sound, I'll be bound, sitting in Jesus' hand. Come one, come all, come my lambs, Elder Jones would shout, and put it down for Jesus. Poor old washer ladies, big fat cooks, long lean truck drivers, and heavy set roustabouts would come up and lay their money down 2 times every evening for Elder Jones. That minister was getting rich right there in that St. Louis alley. In His Hand, in His Hand, I'll have you know I'm white as snow, sitting in Jesus' hand. With the piano just a-going, tambourines a-flying, and people shouting right up on to the altar. Rock, church, rock! Elder Jones would cry at such intensely lucrative moments. But he were too ambitious. He wouldn't let well enough alone. He wanted to be a big shot in Panic Harlem, Gas Detroit, Sew Up Chicago, then move on to Hollywood. He weren't satisfied with just St. Louis. So he got to thinking. Now, what can I do to get everybody excited? To get everybody talking about my church? To get the streets outside crowded and my name known all over, even unto the far reaches of the nation? Now, what can I do? Billy Sunday had a sawdust trail, so he had heard. Reverend Becton had 2 valets in the pulpit with him as he cast off garment after garment in the heat of preaching and used up dozens of white handkerchiefs every evening wiping his brow while calling on the Lord to come. Meanwhile, the angel of Angelus Temple had just kept on getting married and divorced and making the front pages of everybody's newspapers. I gots to be news, too, in my day and time, mused Elder Jones. This town's too small for me. I want the world to hear my name. Now, as I said before, Elder Jones was a good preacher, and a good-looking preacher, too. He could cry real loud and moan real deep, and he could move the sisters as no other black preacher on this side of town had ever moved them before. Besides, in his youth, as a sinner, he had done a little light hustling around Memphis and Vicksburg, so he knew just how to appeal to the feminine nature. Since his recent sojourn in St. Louis, Elder Jones had been looking for a special female lamb to shelter in his private fold. Out of all the sisters in his church, he had finally chosen Sister Maggie Bradford. Not that Sister Maggie was pretty. No. Far from it, but Sister Maggie was well-fed, brown-skinned, good-natured, fat, and prosperous. She owned 4 two-family houses that she rented out, upstairs and down, so she made a good living. Besides, she had sweet and loving ways as well as the interest of her pastor at heart.
Elder Jones confided his personal ambitions to said Sister Bradford one morning when he woke up to find her by his side.
"I want to branch out, Maggie," he said. "I want to be a really big man. Now, what can I do to get the attention of the world onto me? I mean in a religious way."
They thought and they thought. Since it was a 4th of July morning and Sister Maggie didn't have to go collect rents, they just lay there and thought. Finally, Sister Maggie said,
"Bill Jones, you know something I ain't never forgot that I seed as a child? There was a preacher down in Mississippi named Old Man Eubanks who one time got himself dead and buried and then rose from the dead. Now, I ain't never forgot that. Neither has nobody else in that part of the Delta. That's something memorable. Why don't you do something like that?"
"How'd he do it, Sister Maggie?"
"He ain't never told nobody how he do it, Brother Bill. He said, were the grace of God, that's all."
"It might have been," said Elder Jones. "It might have been."
He lay there and thought a while longer. By and by, he said,
"But, honey, I'm going to do something better than that. I'm going to be nailed on a cross."
"Do Jesus," said Sister Maggie Bradford. "Jones, you's a mess." Now, the elder, in order to pull off his intended miracle, had of necessity to take somebody else into his confidence. So he picked out Brother Hicks, his chief deacon, one of the main pillars of the church long before Jones came as pastor. It was too bad, though, that Jones never knew that Brother Hicks, more familiarly known as Bulldog, used to be in love with Sister Bradford. Sister Bradford neglected to tell the new reverend about any of her former sweethearts. So how was Elder Jones to know that some of them still coveted her and were envious of him in their hearts?
"Hicks," whispered Elder Jones in telling his chief deacon of his plan to die on the cross and then come back to life, "that miracle will make me the greatest minister in the world. No doubt about it. When I get to be world-renowned Bulldog and go traveling about the firmament, I'll take you with me as my chief deacon. You shall be my right hand, and Sister Maggie Bradford shall be my left. Amen."
"I hear you," said Brother Hicks. "I hope it comes true." But if Elder Jones had looked closely, he would have seen an evil light in his deacon's eyes.
"It will come true," said Elder Jones, "if you keep your mouth shut and follow out my instructions, exactly as I lay them down to you. I trust you, so listen. You know and I know that I ain't going to really die. Neither is I really going to be nailed. That's why I want you to help me. I want you to have me a great big cross made, higher than an altar. So high, I has to have a stepladder to get up to it to be nailed there on, and you to nail me. The higher the better, so as they won't see the straps. 'Cause I'm going to be tied on by the straps, you hear? The light will be rose-colored so they can't see the straps. Now, here you come and do the nailing. Nobody else but you. Put them nails between my fingers and toes, not through them. Between. And don't nail too deep. Leave the heads kind of sticking out. You get the job?"
"I get the job," said Brother Bulldog Hicks.
"Then you and me stay right there in the church all night and all day till the next night when the people come back to see me rise. Ever so often, you can let me down to rest a little bit. But as long as I'm on the cross, I play off like I'm dead, particularly when reporters come around. On Monday night, hallelujah, I will rise and take up collection."
"Amen," said Brother Hicks. Well, you couldn't get a near the church on the night that Reverend Jones had had it announced by press, by radio, and by word of mouth that he would be crucified dead, stay dead, and rise. Negroes came from all over St. Louis, East St. Louis, and mighty nigh everywhere else to be present at witnessing of the miracle. Lots of them didn't believe in Reverend Jones, but lots of them did. Sometimes false prophets can bamboozle you so you can't tell yonder from whither, and that's the way Jones had the crowd. The church was packed and jammed, not a seat to be found, and tears were flowing from sorrowing sisters' eyes long before the elder had even approached the cross, which, made out of new lumber right straight from the sawmill, loomed up behind the pulpit. In the rose-colored lights, with big paper lilies that Sister Bradford had made decorating its head and foot, the cross looked mighty pretty. Elder Jones preached a mighty sermon that night, and hot as it was, there was plenty of leaping and jumping and shouting in that crowded church. It looked like the walls would fall. Then when he got through preaching, Elder Jones made a solemn announcement, as he termed it, for a night and a day, his last pronouncement. Church, tonight, as I have told the world, I'm gonna die. I'm gonna be nailed to this cross and let the breath pass from me. But tomorrow, Monday night, August the 21st at 12 p.m., I am coming back to life. Amen. After 24 hours on the cross, hallelujah, and all the city of St. Louis can be saved if they just come out to see me. Now, before I mount the steps to the cross, let us sing for the last time, In His Hand. Because I tell you, that's where I am. As we're singing, let everybody come forward to the collection table and help this church before I go. Give largely. The piano tickled. The tambourines rang, hands clapped. Elder Jones and his children sang, In His Hand, in His Hand, you'll never stay down the devil's way, sitting in Jesus' hand. Oh, in His Hand, in His Hand, though I may die, I'll mount on high, sitting in Jesus' hand. Let us pray. And while every back was bowed in prayer, the elder went up the stepladder to the cross. Brother Hicks followed with a hammer and nails. Sister Bradford wailed at the top of her voice. Woe filled the amen corner. Emotion rocked the church. Folks outside were saying all up and down the street, Lord, I wish we could get in. Listen yonder at that noise. I wonder what is going on. Elder Jones was about to make himself famous. That's what was going on. And all would have went well if it had not been for Brother Hicks, a two-faced rascal. Somehow that night the devil got into Bulldog Hicks and took full possession. The truth of the matter is that Hicks got to thinking about Sister Maggie Bradford and how Reverend Jones had worked up to be her number one man. That made him mad. The old green snake of jealousy began to coil around his heart, right there in the meeting, right there on the steps of the cross. Lord, have mercy. At the very high point of the ceremonies, Hicks had the hammer in one hand, and his other hand was full of nails as he mounted the ladder behind the pastor. He was going up to nail Elder Jones on that sawmill cross. While I'm nailing, I might as well nail him right, Hicks thought. A low-down clinker coming here out of Mississippi to take my woman away from me? He'll never know the pleasure of my help in none of his schemes to out-divine Father. No, sir. Elder Jones had himself all fixed up with a system of straps around his waist, round his shoulder blades, and round his wrists and ankles, hidden under his long black coat. These straps fastened in hooks on the back of the cross, out of sight of the audience, so he could just hang there all sad and sorrowful looking and make out like he was being nailed. Brother Bulldog Hicks was to plant the nails between his fingers and toes. Hallelujah! Rock, church, rock! Excitement was intense. All went well until the nailing began. Elder Jones removed his shoes and socks and in his bare black feet bade farewell to his weeping congregation. As he leaned back against the cross and allowed Brother Hicks to compose him there, the crowd began to moan. But it was when Hicks first placed the first nail between Elder Jones' toes that they became hysterical. Sister Bradford out-yelled them all. Hicks placed that first nail between the big toe and the next toe on the left foot and began to hammer. The foot was well strapped down, so the elder couldn't move it. The closer the head of the nail got to his toes, the harder Hicks struck it. Finally, the hammer collided with Elder Jones' foot, bam, against his big toe.
Oh, go easy, man. Have mercy, shouted the brothers and sisters of the church. Have mercy on our elder.
Once more, the hammer struck his toe, but the all-too-human sound of his surprise and agonized ouch was lost in the tumult of the shouting church.
Bulldog, I said, go easy, hissed the elder. This ain't real.
Brother Hicks desisted, a grim smile on his face. Then he turned his attention to the right foot. There he placed another nail between the toes and began to hammer. Again, as the nail went into the wood, he showed no signs of stopping when the hammer reached the foot. He just kept on landing cruel metallic blows on the elder's bare toenails until the preacher howled with pain, no longer able to keep back a sudden hair-raising cry. The sweat popped out on his forehead and dripped down on his shirt. At first, the elder thought, naturally, that it was just a slip of the hammer on the deacon's part. Then he thought the man must have gone crazy, like the rest of the audience. Then it hurt him so bad, he didn't know what he thought, so he just hollered, "Ow!" It was a good thing the church was full of noise, or they would have heard a strange dialogue.
"My God, Hicks, what are you doing?"
the elder cried, staring wildly at his deacon on the ladder.
"I'm a-nailing you to the cross, Jones, and man, I'm really nailing." "Oh, don't you know you're hurting me? I told you not to nail so hard."
But the deacon was unruffled. "Who'd you say was going to be your right hand when you get down from here and start your travelings?" Hicks asked.
"You, brother," the sweating elder cried. "And who'd you say was going to be your left hand?" "Sister Maggie Bradford," moaned Elder Jones from the cross. "No, she ain't," said Brother Hicks, whereupon he struck the reverend's toe a really righteous blow.
"Lord, help me," cried the tortured minister.
The weeping congregation echoed his cry. It was certainly real. The elder was being crucified. Brother Bulldog Hicks took two more steps up the ladder, preparing to nail the hands. With his evil face right in front of Elder Jones, he hissed,
"I'll teach you nappy-headed jackleg ministers to come to St. Louis and think you can all walk away with any woman you's mine to. I'm gonna teach you to leave my women alone. Here's a nail."
Brother Hicks placed a great big spike right in the palm of Elder Jones' left hand. He was just about to drive it in when the frightened reverend let out a scream that could be heard two blocks away. At the same time, he began to struggle to get down. Jones tried to bust the straps, but they were too strong for him. If he could just get one foot loose to kick Brother Bulldog Hicks. Hicks lifted the hammer to let go when the reverend's second yell, this time, was loud enough to be heard in East St. Louis. It burst like a bomb above the shouts of the crowd, and it had its effect. Suddenly, the congregation was quiet. Everybody knew that was no way for a dying man to yell. Sister Bradford realized that something had gone wrong, so she began to chant the song her beloved pastor had told her to chant at the proprietous moment after the nailing was done. Now, even though the nailing was not done, Sister Bradford thought she had better sing,
"Elder Jones will rise again. Elder Jones will rise again. Rise again, rise again. Elder Jones will rise again. Yes, Lord."
But nobody took up the refrain to help her carry it on. Everybody was too interested in what was happening in front of them, so Sister Bradford's voice just died out. Meanwhile, Brother Hicks lifted the hammer again, but Elder Jones spat right in his face. He not only spat, but suddenly called his deacon a name unworthy of man or beast. Then he let out another frightful yell, and in mortal anguish called, "Sister Maggie Bradford, let me down from here. I say, come and get me down from here." Those in the church that had not already stopped moaning and had shouting did so at once. You could have heard a pin drop. Folks were petrified. Brother Hicks stood on the ladder, glaring with satisfaction at Reverend Jones, his hammer still raised. Under his breath, the panting elder dared him to nail another nail and threatened to kill him stone dead with a .44 if he did. "Just let me get loose from here, and I'll fight you like a natural man," he gasped, twisting and turning like a tree in a storm. "Come down, then," yelled Hicks right out loud from the ladder. "Come on down. As sure as water runs, Jones, I'll show you up for what you is, a woman-chasing, no-good, low-down faker. I'll beat you to a batter with my bare hands." "Lord have mercy," cried the church. Jones almost broke a blood vessel trying to get loose from his cross. "Sister Maggie, come and let me down," he pleaded, sweat streaming from his face. But Sister Bradford was covered with confusion. In fact, she was petrified. What could have gone wrong for the elder to call on her like this in public, in the very midst of the thing that was to bring him famous glory and make them all rich, preaching throughout the land with her at his side? Sister Bradford's head was in a whirl. Her heart was in her mouth. "Elder Jones, you means you really wants to get down?" she asked weakly from her seat in the Amen corner. "Yes," cried the elder. "Can't you hear? I done called on you 20 times to let me down." At this point, Brother Hicks gave the footnails one more good hammering. The words that came from the cross were not to be found in the Bible. In a twinkling, Sister Bradford was at Jones' side. Realizing at last that the devil must have gotten into Hicks, like it used to sometimes in the days when she knowed him, she went to the aid of her battered elder, grabbed the foot of the ladder, and sent Hicks sprawling across the pulpit.
"You'll never crucify my elder," she cried. "Not for real."
Energetically, she began to cut the straps away that bound the reverend. Soon poor Jones slid to the floor, his feet too sore from the hammer's blows to even stand on them without help.
"Just let me get at Hicks," was all Reverend Jones could gasp. "He knowed I didn't want them nails that close."
In the dead silence that took possession of the church, everybody heard him moan,
"Lord, let me get at Hicks,"
as he hobbled away on the protecting arm of Sister Maggie.
"Stand back, bulldog," Sister Maggie said to the deacon, "and let your pastor pass. Soon as he is able, he'll flatten you out like a shadow. But now I'm in charge. Stand back, I say, and let him pass."
Hicks stood back. The crowd murmured. The minister made his exit. Thus ended the ambitious career of Elder William Jones. He never did pastor in St. Louis anymore. Neither did he fight Hicks. He just snuck away for parts unknown.
You are listening to Black Books Live.
At every performance, lots of white people wept. And almost every Sunday while they were on tour, some white minister invited the Negro actor who played God to address his congregation and thus help improve race relations, because almost everywhere they needed improving. Although the play had been the hit of the decade in New York, its Negro actors and singers were paid much less than the white actors and singers would have been paid for performing it. And although the white producer and his backers made more than $500,000, the colored troopers on tour lived in cheap hotels and often slept in beds that were full of bugs. Only the actor who played God would sometimes,
by the hardest, achieve accommodations in a white hotel, or be put up by some nice white family, or be invited to the home of the best Negroes in town. Thus, God probably thought that everything was lovely in the world. As an actor, he really got very good write-ups in the papers. Then they were booked to play Washington, and that's where the trouble began. Washington, the capital of the United States, is, as every Negro knows, a town where no black man was allowed inside a downtown theater, not even in the gallery, until very recently. The legitimate playhouses had no accommodations for colored people. Incredible as it may seem, until Ingrid Bergman made her stand, Washington was worse than the Deep South in that respect. But God wasn't at all worried about playing Washington. He thought surely his coming would improve race relations. He thought it would be fine for the good people of the Capitol to see him, a colored God, even if Negroes couldn't. Not even those Negroes who worked for the government. Not even the black congressmen. But several weeks before the Washington appearance of the famous Negro play about charming darkies who drank eggnog at a fish fry in heaven, storm clouds began to rise. It seemed that the Negroes of Washington, strangely enough, had decided that they, too, wanted to see this play. But when they approached the theater management on the question, they got a cold shoulder. The management said they didn't have any seats to sell Negroes. They couldn't even allot a corner in the upper gallery. There was such a heavy ticket demand from white folks. Now, this made the Negroes of Washington mad, especially those who worked for the government and constituted the best society. The teachers at Howard got mad, too, and the ministers of the colored churches who wanted to see what a black heaven looked like on that stage. But nothing doing. The theater management was adamant. They really couldn't sell seats to Negroes. Although they had no scruples about making a large profit on the week's work of Negro actors, they couldn't permit Negroes to occupy seats in the theater. So the Washington Negroes wrote directly to God, this colored God who had been such a hit on Broadway. They thought surely he would help them. Several organizations, including the Negro Ministerial Alliance, got in touch with him when he was playing Philadelphia. What a shame, they said by letter, that the white folks will not allow us to come see you perform in Washington. We are getting up a protest. We want you to help us. Will you? Now, God knew that for many years, white folks had not allowed Negroes in Washington to see any shows, not even in the churches, let alone in theaters. So how come they suddenly thought they ought to be allowed to see God in a white playhouse? Besides, God was getting paid pretty well and was pretty well known. So he answered their letters and said that although his ink was made of tears and his heart bled, he couldn't afford to get into trouble with equity. Also, it wasn't his place to go around the country spreading dissension and hate, but rather love and beauty. And it would surely do the white folks of the District of Columbia a lot of good to see him, and it would soften their hearts to hear the beautiful Negro spirituals and witness the lovely black angels in his play. The black drama lovers of Washington couldn't get any real satisfaction out of God by mail, their colored God. So when the company played Baltimore, a delegation of the Washington Negroes went over to the neighboring city to interview him. In Baltimore, Negroes at least were allowed to sit in the galleries of the theaters. After the play, God received the delegation in his dressing room and wept about his inability to do anything concerning the situation. He had, of course, spoken to his management about it, and they thought it might be possible to arrange a special Sunday night performance for Negroes. God said it hurt him to his soul to think how his people were mistreated, but the play must go on. The delegation left in a huff, but not before they had spread their indignation to other members of the cast of the show. Then among the angels there arose a great discussion as to what they might do about the Washington situation. Although God was the star, the angels, too, were part of the play. Now, among the angels, there was a young Negro named Johnny Logan, who never really liked being an angel, but who, because of his baritone voice and Negro features, had gotten the job during the first rehearsals in New York. Now, since the play had been running 3 years, he was an old hand at being an angel. Logan was from the South, but he hadn't stayed there long after he grew up. The white folks wouldn't let him. He was the kind of young Negro most Southern white people hate. He believed in fighting prejudice and bucking against the traces of discrimination and Jim Crow, and in trying to knock down any white man who insulted him. So he was only about 18 when the whites ran him out of Augusta, Georgia. He came to New York, married a waitress, got a job as a red cap, and would have settled down forever in a little flat in Harlem had not some of his friends discovered that he could sing. They persuaded him to join the Red Cap Quartet. Out of that had come this work as a black angel in what turned out to be a Broadway success in the midst of the Depression. Just before the show went on the road, his wife had their first kid, so he needed to hold his job as a singing angel, even if it meant going on tour. But the more he thought about their forthcoming appearance in a Washington theater that wasn't even Jim Crow, but barred Negroes altogether, the madder Logan got. Finally, he got so mad that he caused the rest of the cast to organize a strike. At that distance from Washington, black angels, from tenors to basses, sopranos to blues singers, were up in arms. Everybody in the cast, except God, agreed to strike. The idea of a town where colored folks can't even sit in the gallery to see an all-colored show. I ain't gonna work there myself. We'll show them white folks we got spunk for once. We'll pull off the biggest actor strike you ever seen. We sure will. That was in Philadelphia. In Baltimore, their ardor had cooled down a bit, and it was all Logan could do to hold his temper as he felt his fellow angels weakening.
Man, I got a wife to take care of. I can't lose no week's work.
I got a wife, too, said Logan, and a kid besides, but I'm game.
You ain't a trooper, said another as he sat in the dressing room putting on his makeup.
Naw. If you was, you'd be used to playing all white houses. In the old days, said the man who played Methuselah, powdering his gray wig. I know all about the old days, said Logan, when black minstrels blacked up even blacker and made fun of themselves for the benefit of white folks. But who wants to go back to the old days?
Anyhow, let's let well enough alone, said Methuselah.
You guys have got no guts. That's all I can say, said Logan.
You just one of them radicals, son. That's what you are, put in the old tenor who played Saul. We know when we want to strike or don't.
Listen then, said Logan to the angels who were putting on their wings by now, as it was near curtain time. If we can't make it a real strike, then let's make it a general walkout on the opening night. Strike for one performance anyhow. At least show folks that we won't take it laying down. Show those Washington Negroes we back them up, theoretically anyhow.
One day ain't so bad, said a skinny black angel. I'm with you on a one-day strike.
Me too,
several others agreed as they crowded into the corridor door at curtain time. The actor who played God was standing in the wings in his frock coat.
Shh,
he said. Monday in Washington. The opening of that famous white play about black life in a scenic heaven. Original New York cast, songs as only Negroes can sing them. Uncle Tom come back as God. Negro Washington wanted to picket the theater, but the police had an injunction against them. Cops were posted for blocks around the playhouse to prevent a riot. Nobody could see God. He was safely housed in the quiet home of a conservative Negro professor, guarded by two detectives. The papers said black radicals had threatened to kidnap him. To kidnap God. Logan spent the whole day rallying the flagging spirits of his fellow actors, talking to them in their hotel rooms.
They were solid for the one-day strike when he was around, and weak when he wasn't. No telling what Washington cops might do to them if they struck. They lock Negroes up for less than that in Washington. Besides, they might get canned. They might lose their pay. They might never get no more jobs on the stage. It was all right to talk about being a man and standing up for your race and all that, but hell, even an actor has to eat. Besides, God was right. It was a great play, a famous play. They ought to hold up its reputation. It did white folks good to see Negroes in such a play. Logan must be crazy. Listen here, you might as well get wise. Ain't nobody gonna strike tonight, one of the men told him about 6 o'clock in the lobby of the Colored White Law Hotel. You just as well give up. You're right. We ain't got no guts. I won't give up, said Logan. When the actors reached the theater, they found it surrounded by cops and the stage was full of detectives. In the lobby, there was a long line of people, white, of course, waiting to buy standing room. God arrived with motorcycle cops in front of his car. He had come a little early to address the cast. With him was the white stage manager and a representative of the New York producing office. They called everybody together on the stage. The Lord wept as he spoke of all his race had borne to get where Negroes are today. Of how they had struggled, of how they had sang, of how they must keep struggling and singing until white folks see the light. A strike would do no good. A strike would only hurt their cause. With sorrow in his heart, but more noble because of it, he would go on with the play. He was sure his actors, his angels, his children would continue too. The white men accompanying God were very solemn, as though hurt to their souls to think what their Negro employees were suffering, but far more hurt to think that Negroes had wanted to jeopardize a week's box office receipts by a strike. That would really harm everybody. Behind God and the white manager stood two big detectives. Needless to say, the Negroes finally went downstairs to put on their wings and makeup. All but Logan. He went downstairs to drag the cast out by force, to make men of darkies, to carry through the strike. But he couldn't. Not alone. Nobody really wanted to strike. Nobody wanted to sacrifice anything for race, pride, decency, or elementary human rights. The actors only wanted to keep on appearing in a naive dialect play about a quaint, funny heaven full of niggers at which white people laughed and wept. The management sent two detectives downstairs to get Logan. They were taking no chances. Just as the curtain rose, they carted him off to jail for disturbing the peace. The colored angels were all masked in the wings for the opening spiritual when the police took the black boy out, a line of tears running down his cheeks. Most of the actors wanted to think Logan was crying because he was being arrested. But in their souls, they knew that was not why he wept.
We're not done yet. Plug in your headphones. You're tuned into Black Books Live.
You are listening to Black Books Live.
In that amazing city of Manhattan where people are forever building things anew, during Prohibition times there lived a young Negro called Valerio Gutierrez, whose mother was a Harlem laundress, but whose father was a Puerto Rican sailor. Valerio grew up in the streets. He was never much good at school, but he was swell at selling papers, pitching pennies, or shooting pool. In his late teens, he became one of the smoothest dancers in the Latin American quarter, north of Central Park. Long before the rumba became popular, he knew how to do it in the real Cuban way that made all the girls afraid to dance with him. Besides, he was very good-looking. At 17, an elderly Chilean lady who owned a beauty parlor called La Flor began to buy his neckties.
At 18, she kept him in pocket money and let him drive her car. At 19, younger and prettier women, a certain comely Spanish widow, also one Dr. Barrio's pale wife, began to see that he kept well-dressed.
"You never amount to nothing, Hattie," his brown-skinned mother said. "Why don't you get a job and work? It's that foreign blood in you. That's what it is, just like your father."
"Que va?"
Valerio replied, grinning.
"Don't you speak Spanish to me," his mama said. "You know I don't understand it."
"Okay, ma," Valerio said.
"Yo voy a trabajar."
"You better trabajar," his mama answered. "And I mean work. I'm tired of coming home every night from that Chinese laundry and finding you gone to the dogs. I'm going to move out of this here Spanish neighborhood anyhow. Way up into Harlem where some real colored people is. I mean American Negroes. There ain't nobody setting a decent example for you down here amongst all these Cubans and Puerto Ricans and things. I don't care if your father was one of them. I never did like him real well."
"Oh, Ma, why don't you ever learn Spanish and stop talking like a spook?"
"Don't you spook me, you young hound, you. I won't stand it. Just because you're straight-haired and yellow and got that foreign blood in you, don't you spook me. I'm your mother and I won't stand for it, you hear me?"
"Yes, ma'am. But you know what I mean. I mean, stop talking like most colored folks. Just because you're not white, you don't have to get back in the corner and stay there. Can't we live nowhere else but up in Harlem, for instance? Down here on 106th Street, white and colored families live in the same house. Spanish-speaking families, some white, some black. What do you want to move further up into Harlem for, where everybody's all black? Lots of my friends down here are Spanish and Italian, and we get along swell."
"That's just what I'm talking about," said his mother. "That's just why I'm going to move. I can't keep track of you, running around with a fast foreign crowd, all mixed up with every whatchamacallit, letting all shades of women give you money. Besides, no matter where you move or what language you speak, you're still colored lest your skin is white."
"Well, I won't be," said Valerio. "I'm American, Latin American."
"Huh," said his mama. "It's just by luck that you even got good hair."
"What's that got to do with being an American?"
"A mighty lot," said his mama, "in America." They moved. They moved up to 143rd Street, in the very middle of American Harlem. There, Hattie Gutierrez was happier, for in her youth, her name had been Jones, not Gutierrez, just plain colored Jones. She had come from Virginia, not Latin America. She had met the Puerto Rican seaman in Norfolk, had lived with him there and in New York for some 10 or 12 years, and borne him a son, meanwhile working hard to keep him and their house in style. Then one winter he just disappeared, probably missed his boat in some far-off port town, settled down with another woman, and went on dancing rumbas and drinking rum without worry. Valerio, whom Gutierrez left behind, was a handsome child, not quite as light as his father, but with olive-yellow skin and Spanish-black hair, more foreign than Negro. As he grew up, he became steadily taller and better-looking. Most of his friends were Spanish-speaking, so he possessed their language as well as English. He was smart and amusing out of school, but he wouldn't work. That was what worried his mother. He just wouldn't work. The long hours and low wages most colored fellows received during Depression times never appealed to him. He could live without struggling, so he did. He liked to dance and play billiards. He hung out near the Cuban Theater at 110th Street, around the pool halls and gambling places, in the taxi dance emporiums. He was all for getting the good things out of life. His mother's moving back to 143rd Street didn't improve conditions any. Indeed, it just started the ball rolling faster, for here Valerio became what is known in Harlem as a big-timer, a young sport, a hep cat, in other words, a man about town. His sleek-haired yellow star rose in a chocolate sky. He was seen at all the formal invitational affairs given by the exclusive clubs of Harlem's younger set, although he belonged to no clubs. He was seen at midnight shows stretching into the dawn. He was even asked to Florida Sutton's famous Thursday Midnight at Homes, where visiting dukes, English authors, colored tap dancers, and dinner-coated downtowners vied for elbow room in her small Sugar Hill apartment. Hattie, Valerio's mama, still kept her job ironing in the Chinese laundry, but nobody bothered about his mama. Valerio was a nice enough boy, though, about sharing his income with her, about pawning a ring or something someone would give to him to help her out on the rent or the insurance policies. And maybe, once or twice a week, Mama might see her son coming in as she went out in the morning or leaving as she came in at night, for Valerio often slept all day, and she would mutter, "The Lord knows, 'cause I don't, what will become of you, boy. You just like your father." Then, strangely enough, one day Valerio got a job. A good job, too. At least it paid him well. A friend of his ran an after-hours nightclub on Upper St. Nicholas Avenue. Gangsters owned the place, but they let a Negro run it. They had a red-hot jazz band, a high yellow review, and bootleg liquor. When the Cuban music began to hit Harlem, they hired Valerio to introduce the Roomba. That was something he was really cut out to do, the Roomba. That wasn't work. Not at all, hombre. But it was a job, and his mama was glad. Attired in a yellow silk shirt, white satin trousers, and a bright red sash, Valerio danced nightly to the throbbing drums and seed-filled rattles of the tropics, accompanied by the orchestra's unusual instruments of joy. Valerio danced with a little brown Cuban girl in a red dress, Concha, whose hair was a mat of darkness and whose hips were nobody's business. Their dance became the talk of the town, at least of that part of the town composed of nightlifers, for Valerio danced the Roomba as his father had taught him to dance in Norfolk when he was 10 years old, innocently. Unexpurgated, happy, funny, but beautiful too, like a gay, sweet longing for something that might be had, sometime, maybe, someplace or other. Anyhow, business boomed. Ringside tables filled with people who came expressly to see Valerio dance.
"He's marvelous,"
gasped ladies who ate at the Ritz anytime they wanted to. "That boy can dance," said portly gentlemen with offices full of lawyers to keep track of their income tax.
"He can dance,"
and they wished they could, too.
"Hot stuff,"
said the young rum runners, smoking reefers and drinking gin, for these were prohibition days.
"A natural-born Eastman,"
cried a tan-skinned lady with a diamond wristwatch.
"He can have anything I got."
That was the trouble. Too many people felt Valerio could have anything they had, so he lived on the fat of the land without making half an effort. He began to be invited to fashionable cocktail parties downtown. He often went out to dinner in the East 50s with white folks, but his mama still kept her job in the Chinese laundry. Perhaps it was a good thing she did in view of what finally happened. For to Valerio, the world was nothing but a swagger world, tingling with lights, music, drinks, money, and people who had everything. Or thought they had. Each night at the club, the orchestra beat out its astounding songs, shook its rattles, fingered its drums. Valerio put on his satin trousers with a fiery red sash to dance with the little Cuban girl who always had the look of pleased surprise on her face, as though amazed to find dancing so good. Somehow she and Valerio made their Roomba, for all their hip shaking, clean as a summer sun. Offers began to come in from other nightclubs, and from small producers as well.
"Wait for something big, kid,"
said the man who ran the cabaret.
"Wait till the Winter Garden calls you."
Valerio waited. Meanwhile, a dark young rounder named Sonny, who wrote number bets for a living, had an idea for making money off of Valerio. They would open an apartment together where people could come after the nightclubs closed, come and drink and dance, and love a little if they wanted to. The money would be made from the sale of drinks, charging very high prices to keep the riffraff out. With Valerio as a host, a lot of good spenders would surely call. They could get rich.
"Okay by me,"
said Valerio.
"I'll run the place," said Sonny, "and all you gotta do is just be there and dance a little, maybe, you know, and make people feel at home."
"Okay," said Valerio, and we'll split the profit two ways, me and you.
Okay.
So they got a big 7th Avenue apartment, furnished it with deep, soft sofas and lots of little tables and a huge ice box, and opened up. They paid off the police every week. They had good whiskey. They sent out cards to 100 downtown people who didn't care about money. They informed the best patrons of the cabaret where Valerio danced, the white folks who thrilled at becoming real Harlem initiates going home with Valerio. From the opening night on, Valerio's flat filled with white people from midnight till the sun came up. Mostly a sporty crowd, young blades accompanied by ladies of the chorus, racetrack gentlemen, white cabaret entertainers out for amusement after their own places closed, musical comedy stars in search of their new dance steps, and perhaps 3 or 4 brown-skinned ladies of the evening and a couple of chocolate gigolos to add color. There was a piano player. Valerio danced. There was an impromptu entertaining by the guest. Often famous radio stars would get up and croon. Expensive nightclub names might rise to do a number, or several numbers if they were tight enough. And sometimes it would be hard to stop them when they really got going. Occasionally guests would get very drunk and stay all night, sleeping well into the day. Sometimes one might sleep with Valerio. Shortly, all Harlem began to talk about the big red roadster Valerio drove up and down 7th Avenue. It was all nickel-plated, and a little blonde review star known on 2 continents had given it to him, so folks said. Valerio was on his way to becoming a gigolo deluxe. "That boy sure don't draw no color lines," Harlem commented. "No, sir." "And why should he?" Harlem then asked itself rhetorically. "Colored folks ain't got no money, and money's what he's after, ain't it?" But Harlem was wrong. Valerio seldom gave a thought to money. He was having too good a time. That's why it was well his mama kept her job in the Chinese laundry, for one day Sonny received a warning. "Close up that flat of yours, and close it damn quick. Gangsters."
"What the hell?"
Sonny answered the racketeers.
"We're paying off, ain't we? You and the police both, so what's wrong?"
"Close up or we'll break you up," the warning came back. "We don't like the way you're running things, black boy, and tell Valerio to send that white chick's car back to her, and quick."
"Aw, nuts," said Sonny. "We're paying the police. You guys lay off."
But Sonny wasn't wise. He knew very well how little the police count when gangsters give orders, yet he kept right on. The profits had gone to his head. He didn't even tell Valerio that they had been warned, for Sonny, who was trying to make enough money to start a number bank of his own, was afraid the boy might quit. Sonny should have known better. One Sunday night about 3:30 a.m., the piano was going like mad. 14 couples packed the front room, dancing close and warm. There were at least 12 folks whose name you'd know if you saw them in any paper, famous from Hollywood to Westport. They were feeling good. Sonny was busy at the door, and a brown bar boy was collecting highball glasses as Valerio came in from the club where he still worked. He went in the bathroom to change his dancing shoes, for it was snowing and his feet were cold.
"Oh, rock me pretty mama till the cows come home," sang a sleek-haired Harlemite at the piano. Rock me, baby, from night to morn."
When just then a crash like the wreck of the Hesperus resounded through the hall and shook the whole house, as 5 Italian gentlemen in evening clothes who looked exactly like gangsters walked in. They had broken down the door. Without a word, they began to smash up the place with long axes each of them carried. Women began to scream, men to shout, and the piano vibrated, not from jazz playing fingers, but from axes breaking its hidden heart.
"Let me out!" the piano player yelled. "Let me out!"
But there was panic at the door.
"I can't leave without my wrap. Where's my wrap? Sonny, my ermine coat."
"Don't move," one of the gangsters said to Sonny. A big white fist flattened his brown nose.
"Ought to kill you," said the second gangster. "You were warned. Take this."
Sonny spit out 2 teeth. Crash went the axes on furniture and bar. Splintered glass flew, wood cracked. Guests fled, hatless and coatless. About that time, the police arrived. Strangely enough, the police, instead of helping protect the place from the gangsters, began themselves to break not only the furniture, but also the heads of every Negro in sight. They started with Sonny. They laid the barman and the waiter low. They grabbed Valerio as he emerged from the bedroom. They beat his face to a pulp. They whacked the piano player twice across the buttocks. They had a grand time with their nightsticks. Then they arrested all the colored fellows and no whites as the gangsters took their axes and left. That was the end of Valerio's apartment. In jail, Valerio learned that the woman who gave him the red roadster was being kept by a gangster who controlled Prohibition's whole champagne racket and owned dozens of rum-rumming boats.
No wonder, said Sonny through his bandages. He got them guys to break up our place. He probably told the police to beat the hell out of us, too. Wonder how he knew she gave me the car, asked Valerio innocently.
White folks know everything, said Sonny.
Aw, stop talking like a spook, said Valerio.
When he got out of jail, Valerio's face had a long nightstick scar across it that would never disappear. He still felt weak and sick and hungry. The gangsters had forbidden any of the nightclubs to employ him again, so he went back home to Mama.
Mm-hmm, she told him. Good thing I kept my job in that Chinese laundry. It's a good thing. Sit down and eat, son. What you gonna do now?
Start practicing dancing again. I got a job offer to go to Brazil, a big club in Rio.
Who's gonna pay your fare down yonder to Brazil?
Concha, Valerio answered, the name of his Cuban rumba partner whose hair was a mat of darkness.
Concha. A woman, cried his mother. I might have known it. We're weak that way. My God, I don't know, boy. I don't know.
You don't know what? Asked Valerio, grinning.
How women can help it, said his mama. The Lord knows you're just like your father. And I took care of him for 10 years. I reckon it's that Spanish blood.
Que va, said Valerio.
You are listening to Black Books Live.
Thank you again for tuning in to Black Books Live. It was certainly a pleasure to share with you the amazing stories by Langston Hughes. And we're going to continue this journey. Next time, we're going to travel across the Big Pond, and we're going to celebrate the writing and genius of Ghanaian author Ayikwe Arma. So tell a friend about us. We're on iTunes, and we're also on Podomatic. Share it when you can on social media, and we look forward to continuing to bring you the best in Black literature. This is Jason Harris, your host, and I say to you, onward and upward.
You are listening to Black Books Live.